Welcome to the Lobot Lounge, the gathering place for the Gentleman Nerds. The Gentleman Nerds are three entertainment aficionados who know each other through various media endeavors, getting together to talk about all things nerdy, mostly in the vein of film, television, toys, and popular culture. Many topics are discussed, so please be warned. There are the potential for many spoilers. If you like what you hear, you can listen to past shows on iTunes or on our website, TheGentlemanNerds.com. And now, enjoy the show. Space. It is the final frontier. Today, in the Lobot Lounge, we, the Gentleman Nerds, are going to take a voyage with the Starship Enterprise. We are going to explore strange new worlds. We're going to seek out new life and new civilization. We are boldly going to kick a behind where no behind has been kicked before. Ladies and gentlemen, in honor of the recent anniversary of the original series, Star Trek, premiering on September 8th, 1966, the Gentleman Nerds have decided that it's long past due to pay tribute to that groundbreaking show created by Gene Roddenberry, which took our imaginations wagon train style across the stars. Our Star Trek original series episode, Before You Hear, in the Lobot Lounge. Gathered to discuss the original series and all things Trek are Mark Finn.
You managed to kill just about everyone else, but like a poor marksman, you keep missing the target.
Aaron DeArrive.
I'm a writer, not a doctor.
And I am your host and emotional touchstone, Joseph Fotinos. Welcome to the Gentleman Nerds.
Live right. Long and prosper.
We're here. Yes. We're here. Oh, it's long and coming. I can't believe we haven't done this before.
Yeah, me either. Me either.
Sort of surprised. This is one of the most venerable, if not the most venerable science fiction franchise extant. And the fact that it continues to reinvent itself and re-perpetuate and repopulate is, I think, a testament to the strength of the idea, and certainly the ideals that Roddenberry infused the original series with.
Well, you know, he like I mentioned in the opening, he did pitch it to CBS as sort of a Western in space, a wagon train in space. He wanted to do, you know, the exploration, like a Horatio Hornblower kind of thing going on in space. And, you know, talk about a concept that is ripe for picking social commentary and justice, and had the most diverse cast on television, you know, of ethnicities and all kinds I remember an early episode of Star Trek where somebody accused Spock of being, cause it was like the first time they met a Romulan. And the minute they saw Romulans who looked a lot like Vulcans, everyone looked at Spock, and Kirk dressed down a couple of his crew members. Said, "We won't have that talk on this ship." You know, I mean, it was very straight out of the gate. They were like, we are well beyond any kind of racism. We are well beyond any kind of bigotry and hatred. We are the United Federation of Planets, buddy. Come on, you know, I love that.
I gotta say,
very much a groundbreaking show. I mean, no doubt.
I love the fact that, some of my favorite characters, you know, I growing up in the 70s, this was all reruns for me, right? It was syndicated. So it was usually a Saturday night or a Sunday night when it was on. And it was usually paired up with Blake Seven or sometimes Doctor Who. KRA used to run them, and then later it went over to WFAA. And so it was so nice because I didn't realize what a big deal it was to have Lieutenant Uhura on the bridge. I didn't realize it didn't occur to me that Chekhov was our enemy.
Right.
In real life, you know, or that Sulu, you know, was our enemy. It just didn't occur to me. And I think that's one of the things that I've always admired about the original Trek, in a way that maybe some of the other Treks didn't quite do.
Right.
I used to say when that Star Trek was politically active, Star Trek Next Generation was politically correct. But
yes,
more to the point, what they did in at least in the first three seasons is they didn't demonstrate so much as just did it. Right. There was no commentary on the fact that these people were a diverse cast. We could see that they were a diverse cast.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the strength of how those ideas were able to take hold like they did. All second is allegory, and they were able to do some really good allegory.
Yeah.
With this setup.
No doubt. Aaron, yeah, what was your first experience? I came
late to Star Trek, fellas. I was an Irwin Allen kid. I grew up with you know, all the shows that Irwin Allen had done. In fact, I knew about Lost in Space before I had paid any attention. Certainly, I mean, the show Star Trek already existed by the time I was watching Lost in Space, but I wasn't aware of it. You know, I went and saw The Adventures of the Robinsons, and I would watch Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, and I would watch Land of the Giants, and you know, and so you know, and then, but I knew that there was a space show that sort of the older kids watched, and it came out, you know, in the evening, as opposed to the shows that I watched came out in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And it just, for whatever reason, I don't even know why, it never really resonated with me. I didn't have that much interest. I was like, yeah, there's a show at night, and it's got a spaceship on it, and yeah, okay, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I probably started, I would guess I started watching them around the time, because even when Star Wars came out, and I went to see that, I was much more into Star Wars than I was into Star Trek, but because I had started to consume everything space at that point,
right.
And then Battlestar Galactica was out, then I started watching them. I found whatever channel they were being syndicated on, and they were showing them, and then I watched every single one. I knew, okay, well, it's at this time on this channel. Let me check them out.
Yeah.
And then of course I loved them, but we're talking we're talking like mid late 70s.
Yeah,
but when I first watched Star Trek, with any kind of attention, I was aware of it on TV every now and then. I'd see it on TV and like, okay, and I changed the channel.
Right.
But I very much enjoyed it. So a lot of, you know, I was already kind of coming to the show understanding, because people were already talking about things like the diversity of the cast and all of the firsts that they had done. Okay. As far as the first interracial kiss and all this other kind of stuff. And I was like, okay.
Yeah.
And it, you know, after the fact, because then we already had shows like Battlestar Galactica that had black people in the cast and black commanders and, you know, that kind of thing. It wasn't as big of an impact, until I realized that, oh no, these shows came out in, you know, in the mid 60s. This is a big deal.
Yeah.
But yeah, I came late to it, fellas. I'm definitely a Star Trek fan now, but no, I was not a Star Trek fan for the first, you know, 15 or more years of its existence.
Yeah. I actually have to thank our old friend Marty Abrams for introducing me to Star Trek, because I was drawn to Star Trek through Mego. I went to the Mego toys first.
Oh yeah.
I mean, talk about something that pulled me in from the shelves. The design of the packaging with the clamshells, with the blister card. I mean, that had the blue space, and they had the little circles of their faces and the characters, and these primary colors of their uniforms: the yellow and the red and the blue, and the Klingons and aliens and the little pistols and the communicators. And oh, you know, I was drawn in, and so I had to find out what this was. I think a very wonderful Christmas gift one year, and Santa must have really been thinking that I'd love this because he took a gamble. But I got the Enterprise set and, you know, the main characters and a couple of aliens, and I was, this is awesome. Who are these people? So
right.
I had to kind of dive in and looked it up. And of course, it was playing in the evening, you know, in syndication, on Channel 39, I think, in Houston. So I would watch them there, and then just fell in love with them. It became one of those things that they were familiar. You know, I instantly knew everyone's roles. And if you think of it in terms of growing up in middle school or in high school, you know, Spock, the intellectual, Kirk, the dashing ladies' man, Bones, his buddy, you know, there was always an end part of some of the Star Trek episodes where, you know, I like to call, let's mess with the Vulcan, where Bones and Kirk take pot shots lightly at Spock, you know, and through the end of the episode, it was like, well, Spock, you know, it looks like you were wrong about this, or, you know, so what do you think about that, Spock? And let's see his reaction. And, you know, well, that's fascinating because you humans are blah, blah, blah. And it was always kind of a let's mess with Spock moment, you know. And then they'd all laugh together. Well, not Spock, but Bones and Kirk would wink at each other knowingly and then move on to the next adventure. And Spock would raise an eyebrow. And sometimes Spock would give a zinger and just tear them up, you know, and leave them sitting there with their mouth agape, you know, going, oh, okay, yeah.
Funny, speaking of the toys, you reminded me, Joseph. I had gotten, before I'd seen the show, somebody had given me during a Christmas season, mm-hmm. the model kits of the ships, the one that had the three, it had the Klingon, the Warbird, and the Enterprise.
Yes.
And so I had actually built the models and would play with the toys with no reference. I didn't know who the ships belonged to who. I mean, to me, I liked the Klingon one the best, so they were the good guys.
Yeah.
And so they would zoom around and zap, and you know, the Enterprise had the weird saucer ship. And I grew up in the 70s. I know that saucers are bad. Those are the bad aliens. Yeah. And so it was funny. I was playing with Star Trek ships without any context. I had no idea who was what.
Yeah.
And so that just reminded me, like, oh yeah, I used to play with the Star Trek spaceships, but I had no idea
who it was.
Yeah.
Hey guys, I'm thinking about doing something a little fun for this particular discussion over this Romulan ale, which is quite strong, by the way.
It is.
So I think about we maybe just pop up some trivia and see how well we do, just for fun. No one's judging anyone. All right,
I'm gonna suck.
No, we're going to be fine. All right. So in Gene Roddenberry's original treatment for Star Trek, what was the name of the starship?
Oh, God. Endeavor.
Okay. All right.
I'm guessing at this point.
Yeah, I know. That's the Mark. I'll tell you what, Mark, what do you think? Do you know?
I did know it once. And now I don't know. And I'm going to blame that on all the medicinal Romulan ale.
I'm going to give you multiple choice, okay?
Okay.
Was it always Enterprise? Was it the Plymouth? Was it the Reliant? Or was it the Yorktown?
Oh shit. I'm going to go with the Yorktown.
I think it was the Yorktown.
That is correct. Gene Roddenberry's original concept for Star Trek was that of wagging train to the stars and included Starship Yorktown plus very significant characters from the ones we know today. Well done. Well done. Drink up.
That was a complete guess, but that sounded right, didn't it, Mark?
Yeah, that was exciting. Oh, no, I was just going to share one last bit of Mego story that as a kid, we never had the Gorn, and I really wanted the Gorn. Now, the Gorn, in classic Mego Marty Abrams style, was just a reused lizard painted brown and wearing a Klingon uniform. That was the Gorn in the original Star Trek line for Mego. And I never had the Gorn, and I wanted the Gorn, but I had a lizard, so I took my lizard, and I had a Klingon, and I dressed the lizard in Klingon clothes, and because I didn't know any better, tried to paint him brown using Tester's paint for my model. As anyone might know, rubber doesn't necessarily take to that really well, so that his head was sticky. It's my Gorn's head. He was incredibly sticky. That was my attempt to custom a figure.
And you know, if you had left the head alone, you would have had a more accurate Gorn action figure than the actual Mego figure.
I know, because he's green. And I never saw that episode, actually, until much later. I really wanted to see that episode because, you know, a lizard creature? That looks awesome. Quick plug, folks, Mego's back, and the series 2 of the Migos at your local Target includes a screen accurate Mego Gorn. Hell yeah.
Yeah, I saw that. You posted that picture. And it looks really good.
It looks like really the flipping Gorn. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's very exciting.
Mego is awesome. Mego's really just, God, talk about what a comeback. What a comeback. Anyway.
Yeah. So anyway, Star Trek, I tell you,
that was a very legitimizing, that was a very legitimizing thing for Star Trek, right?
Yeah.
You know, if the Migos And I think, with the exception of the superhero line, the Mego line of Star Trek was their second biggest line.
Yeah.
You know, because they had all the bridge crew, all the aliens, generic Klingon, generic Romulan. Right. You know, they had it was clear that this, you know what I mean? And so that I am sure seeing the Star Trek Migos made me want to actually watch the show so yeah. I know how to play with them.
Right. Right. Yeah. The at the time that Migos were popular and that I was introduced to it, I did have Star Trek, the animated series. Now, the original series only ran from 66 to 69. But that the animated series ran from 73 to 74, with most of the original cast returning to do their voices.
Right. And those I watched. Oddly yeah. enough, those I actually watched.
Yeah. 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 It was almost like that was year four. It was supposed to be a 5-year mission, but they only made it through 3 years in the original series. And then another, year in the animated series. Gene Roddenberry is a character. Let's talk about old Gene here for a bit, because... Well, I know. There's good and bad. There's good and bad. I do want to point out, and Mark said it so well, as he usually does, that it wasn't until The Next Generation that we got politically correct. Because there were a lot of things that the original Star Trek got right. But when I first showed this to my son, Edward, the one thing he noticed when he was younger, and we watched the original series Star Trek, he said, "All the ladies are wearing such short skirts. Did Captain Kirk design their uniforms?"
yeah.
And it's true. Some of these uniforms, if some of these crew women bent over, the world is their gynecologist. It's incredibly...
Oh, jeez.
You know, it's very much... So,
oh my God! Please send all hate mail to Joseph Fortinos.
I'm just saying the skirts are short. The skirts are short. Okay, but and so that was a little off-putting, really, when you think about the way we're so advanced now. We all get along. Yet the women seemed a little less, I don't know, strong in the original series. Right. There were a lot of.
I mean, it's very dated. I mean, if you go and you watch those episodes now. Mm-hmm. I mean, one that's particularly embarrassing with how they treat women is the infamous episode with Khan, the space seed.
Oh, yeah.
If you go back and look at the crew member that sort of starts falling in love with Khan and how he treats her and what he says to her and how he manipulates her. I mean, you kind of look around and go like, who wrote this? I mean, yeah. Jesus Christ. Yeah. They're very dated. Many of those episodes are incredibly dated.
Yeah.
Especially in this era, right? Our Me Too era. Wow. Some of those do not hold up.
No.
But again, they did such other wonderful stuff that you kind of overlook that it was still a show being written for an audience in 1966 America.
Right.
So you can forgive it.
It was originally pitched to NBC, and they made a pilot, The Cage, with Jeffrey Hunter as the first captain of the Enterprise, and NBC rejected it. But the executives were still sort of impressed with the concept, and then they decided to go with a second pilot, Where No Man Has Gone Before. The actual first episode of Star Trek was The Man Trap, and that was September 8th, 1966. So that was the first original, the first episode.
And they Joseph, who championed this show from the very beginning and was instrumental in it being actually made?
Oh.
Come on.
Oh, let me think. Uh-huh. It wasn't Roddenberry's wife, was it? Angel Barrett?
Nope.
It
was Lucille Ball and
Desi Lou. That's right.
Desi Lou. Correct. Yes.
Because they were the ones who worked the treatment into a script. That's right. Okay, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So we have Lucy to thank for that. That's exciting.
Yes, we do. Thank you, Lucy.
Yay! But talk about...
Yes. You no longer have a lot of explaining to do.
Right, you're exactly right. But talk about something that became so indelible in our popular culture. With the idea that in season 3, Roddenberry left because he was upset the way they were kind of shifting. They were going to cancel it in season 2, after season 2. And then a letter writing campaign, one of the very first letter writing campaigns, came out. And then they decided to go ahead and move it but they moved it to the Friday night death slot, they call it, and reduced the budget, and Roddenberry got mad and he left the show, and the third season was the final season. And that was they tried to do another letter writing campaign, but it didn't work. Three seasons, 79 episodes, the end. Yep. However, the broadcast syndication rights, boy, I tell you, that developed that cult following that we have today for Star Trek and Star Trek conventions. The very first Star Trek convention, by the way, was in 1972 in New York City. So, and only a couple of hundred attendees.
Right.
You know, I'd say. But I think that it's important to realize that in the era of that, 66 is the year of Batman too. I mean, that's the kind of we're talking about that era, that Star Trek really left its mark as something unique and really out of place. It was like nothing else, right? So which Star Trek actor originally devised the Klingon language? One of the main actors from the original series helped to actually come up with the Klingon language.
Oh, gosh. I know who did it. They eventually developed it into an actual language, I think, by Mark Orkrand, who's the one that they published a book about it. They had a tape that you could listen to. I even know how to say Klingon kol dachatla. Do you speak Klingon? So, yes, I am one of those geeks that actually learned a little bit of Klingon.
Just as a hint, it was the very first time we heard the Klingon language, a different language than, because in the original series, the Klingons looked like they looked like Mexicans, frankly. I mean, they looked like some of my family. I would and Uncle Tita, they're right there on TV.
I would compare them to Mongols, but they had a little of the Latino look to them.
Hey, I'm Mexican. I can do that. But I mean,
It would have had to have been Nimoy, right?
No, actually, and surprisingly enough, it was actor James Doohan who played Scott.
And he was known for having a number of accents. One of his things as a character actor was to have different accents. Mm-hmm. So that makes sense.
He worked with the producer for the Star Trek the Motion Picture, which is the first time we actually heard Klingon speaking in a different language.
Right.
And he helped devise that guttural sound that you hear. In all previous appearances, of course, Klingon spoke English. So there you go.
I wonder when the Mark Orkrand book came out, that where they started probably for the next generation, just because they needed, you know, Worf was going to be meeting Klingons. They were going to be speaking more Klingon. And they probably needed the language to make a little bit more sense.
Early 90s is when the book came out.
Early
92 or 93.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Let's talk about our favorite Star Trek original series episodes. We mentioned a couple already. Space Seed being a standout, because of course it leads into Wrath of Khan with Ricardo Montalban as Khan Noonien Singh, who is rescued in the ship pod with all his other weird genetic freaks and tries to take over the Enterprise, and Kirk beats him down with a pipe. Love it.
Late 20th century genetic engineering.
Oh my god.
That's okay. I got three that absolutely are my go-tos, like the ones that just are like the best ones of all in my mind. A Piece of the Action is one of my all-time favorites. So freaking absurd. The Corbinite Maneuver. And this is sort of, it's kind of controversial because it got messed with so much, but The City on the Edge of Forever, the one by Harlan Ellison, and then re-released with his original script because they changed things, and here we go again, you know. But season two is when things to me really start happening. That's when Cat's Paw came out with Robert Block's script. Good stuff, man. Oh, so fun.
I'm a big fan of Amok Time and Mirror Mirror.
Of course.
Yeah. I love Mirror Mirror because we get evil Kirk and evil Spock. And how do you know he's evil Spock? He has a goatee. And just taking Spock as a character and making him evil and realizing how deadly Mr. Spock would be if he was evil. You know, as smart as he is, oh my gosh. And Kirk being almost Neanderthalist in his cruelty, in his animalistic, the way he acts and everything like that. When Kirk and evil Kirk switch places through a transporter accident and leaves Kirk in the alternate universe, the mirror universe of evil. And all the Enterprise they're walking around and wearing the costumes are different. They all got knives and they're and apparently every female member of the crew has to sleep with Captain Kirk. I mean, it is like a bizarre, you know, alternate reality.
Which I love because later Star Trek series run with that. They actually have several episodes set in the mirror universe, which is very cool.
Yeah, and it's a really unique concept, but it, you know, it hadn't been done before. I think it was popular in the '60s to have identical twins that were acting differently, and then the comedy would ensue, like in the Patty Duke show or the Munsters, or there's an identical character that's like, oh, how come Herman's acting so weird? Because it's bad Herman, not good Herman. And it's a trope that TV used all the time. Yeah. But this was unique because it wasn't just one character. It was the character out of place. It was evil Kirk in our universe and good Kirk in the evil universe.
Yeah.
So that was always kind of fun. A mock time, of course, when they all start getting into their base instincts and going a little mad because of, I think it was a disease on the ship that was causing them to go a little crazy.
Right.
And of course, memorably Sulu running around without his shirt on and a sword.
That's the naked time. That is one of my favorites. Yes.
Okay. So which one's a mock time?
A mock time is, I think that's, isn't that the one where Spock goes into Pon Farr?
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. That's right. Right. That's right. I was thinking of the naked time. That's the one I wanted. But yeah, mock time is good too. That's when, of course, every 7 years he has to take a mate or die?
Yes. Yes. And then he ends up fighting Kirk.
Yes. And the Star Trek fight music. Come on, guys.
Oh my God. Yeah. How can we not remember that one? I'm a big fan, although it's not certainly not considered traditionally, you know, one of sort of the better episodes. But I always remember it just because, you know, it's one of the first ones I saw. It remains sort of a haunting one for me. But Charlie X that one stuck with me. This poor kid that has these powers, godlike powers he cannot control. And then he gets brought up on the ship and he starts interacting with fellow humans that he had never done. And it's just, he's such a tragic character, and the ending with him just saying, I don't want to go. And then he just fades. Yeah. It's certainly not considered one of the better, better episodes, but man, that one stuck with me. I was very fond of that one. And then again, of course, Trouble with Tribbles. How can you not love Trouble with Tribbles? It's just so much fun. And then again, used brilliantly by a later Star Trek show, DS9, where they travel back in time and they go to that episode. And so the DS9 characters are in the Trouble with Tribbles episode, trying not to interact with like any of the major characters so they don't mess up the timeline or anything like that.
Oh, that's fun.
It's one of the better ones, one of my favorite ones from DS9, because of the fact that it deals with that. A Mirror Mirror, certainly I'm with you guys on that one. And you know, come on, Gorn, you're Gorn, Joseph.
Oh, yeah, Arena.
How can you not love Arena?
Arena. So Arena is good. But it's, you know, it's Kirk and they almost, it's cool. The design is cool, but it's sort of laughable in the fact that it's a guy in a big rubber suit going, Yeah. And the Gorn, you know, he's very slow. He's incredibly strong, but very slow. So Kirk is like, you know, karate chopping him left and right. And the Gorn is just like, and he picks up this gigantic styrofoam rock and throws it at Kirk. And it's funny.
A tip of the hat to another episode that you alluded to with the whole, you know, they see Romulans for the first time, but Balance of Terror. I think Balance of Terror is a fantastic episode. With the two captains, you know, sort of pitted against each other, you know, both brilliant captains. So no, that one, you know, there's a lot of good ones.
Oh, Harcourt, Fenton, Mudd.
Yes. Oh yes. Yeah.
Mudd's women.
Yeah.
I love that character. He's appeared twice in the original series. And that's just a delightful, almost pirate-like character, you know, opening up the possibilities of you know, not everyone in the universe is, you know, all out there for altruistic reasons. You know, there are some people out there that do all kinds of things. And I love the idea that, you know, a character like that shows up, and they know him too. It's one of those things that, oh, it's Mudd, you know. I just like that familiarity breeding contempt in that. Yeah, no, that's a good one too. That's a lot
now,
of fun.
Now, one of my one-offs, because, yeah. And it's for really specific reasons, probably that only I give a shit about. A Private Little War is the one with the Mugatu.
Oh yes,
and,
the Salt Vampire, right?
The ape with the horn.
Oh, yes.
And that. That ape costume and that performance was by Janos Proska, who is one of the unsung gorilla men of Hollywood. Yeah. And so
Mark. I'm stunned that you like an episode that has a gorilla in it.
But the Mugatu actually also showed up in Mego in a very laughable way. I don't know if you ever saw the Mugatu in Mego Mugatu.
Yeah, it wasn't good.
No, it was not good. It was not good. And enough said. They sculpted a new head for him. They gave him, you know, a white gorilla head with a horn on it. But he's wearing what looks like a disco outfit with a green jumper and bright red pants. Anyway, Mugatu. Yeah. Neat. Hey, trivia time. What actor from the original series lost his right middle finger during World War II?
Oh, gosh.
That would have had to have been...
DeForest Kelly.
DeForest Kelly, yeah.
Nope, try again.
Oh. Lost his middle finger during World War II.
Then it was Nimoy.
Nimoy? Nope.
Not anymore.
Oh my gosh. I'm doing?
Yes, James.
Not really.
Lost his right middle finger during World War II, and most of the scenes are shot to hide it. In scenes with close-ups of Scotty's hands, someone else's hands are always at the transporter. The most noticeable example, apparently, is in The Trouble of Tribbles. When Scotty comes into the rec room, his arms are filled with tribbles. Take a close look at his hands. You can see he's clearly missing a finger.
Wow.
There you go, folks. We aims to please.
No idea.
Yeah. Him and Radar from MASH, apparently. You notice that in MASH? He's always holding a clipboard. It's because his hand's webbed. He's got a webbed hand.
Weird.
I know. God. So the series ended. The animated series came and went. But then we got Star Trek movie.
Yep.
So the very first Star Trek movie, Star Trek the Motion Picture, which I'll admit, I'm a child of Star Wars first. No offense. Yeah. The motion picture came out in 79. Okay. This is post Star Wars. So you got a lot to live up to, folks. And boy,
They did not.
It was a little sleepy. Yeah. As a kid in 79, I was 10. Even then, I thought to myself, huh, V'ger, Voyager, that's kind of cool. I mean, I kind of thought that the name was neat, you know?
Right.
But I couldn't tell you really much about the movie because I think I slept through most of it.
Yeah, the scenes of Spock in space to this day work as a soporific for me. I go to sleep faster than a rhino being tranquilized by Jim on Wild Kingdom. I mean, I'll just fall down. I'll go in mid-sentence, just thud like that.
No, I mean, no one can debate you. It is not a pulse pounding film.
No, it's not.
I still wonder, like, what if Wrath of Khan had been the first Star Trek movie? Wow, what a difference that would have made, huh? No, you're right. I was lent a copy of somebody, as they do nowadays, a fan went and did a fan edit of the of the motion picture, or as I like to call it, the motionless picture.
Ooh, nice.
And he did a fan edit where he cut out all of the soporific parts and put it back together and uploaded it. And so you can watch a version of it where he's taken all of those slow pans of the ship out where people are just going, oh, look, the Enterprise. Or Spock is sailing through space, looking at various different colors instead of delivering the dialogue he should be delivering that's important, like, oh, it's doing this or it's doing that. And you know what? It makes a difference. It is. Totally. It's a much quicker, like, oh, it almost feels like a super long, big budget episode is what it feels like.
Uh-huh.
And it does. It makes it a much more enjoyable, a much more improved viewing experience.
I wish I remember
what it was called, because I'm sure they've uploaded it somewhere, YouTube or somewhere. You can watch it. Yeah. But it's the cut that has all the boring parts taken out of it.
Yeah.
And it's actually pretty good. It's actually pretty good.
Well,
it's directed by Robert Wise.
Yeah.
So the guy's talented. The creative control was much of Roddenberry. He was a producer on this one. And, of course, he's the one who lobbied for Paramount to continue the franchise through feature films. Surprising no one, when the film lack of action scenes and over-reliance on special effects, big budget, not a good turnup, Roddenberry was forced out of creative control for the sequel, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. A little more action in that one, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for that, we really have Nick Meyer to thank.
Mm.
We do.
He was the guy that wrote the 7% Solution. Which was the novel that got made into a movie about Sherlock Holmes and Sigmund Freud, where Sherlock Holmes tries to kick his addiction to cocaine. He also did one of the Holmes Dracula stories.
Okay.
Meyer's good. His novels are really good, and so. You can really tell that they got a story driven guy onto, because right out of the shoot, we get the obligatory money shot of, oh, look, it's the Enterprise in dry dock.
Right.
But over that is, I for one will be glad to have you at the helm for 2 weeks. I don't think these kids can steer.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah.
And he brought in the thing that was missing from the first movie, and that was the character interaction.
At the heart
of Star Trek is these characters colliding into one another.
Absolutely.
Right up into the whole thing where they're putting all the pieces together and why, what's she working on and all this, and you got Bones talking about Genesis, you know, look out, I will do it for you in 6 minutes. And, you know, and he and Spock get into the thing, and Dr. McCoy turns on him and says, you green-blooded, inhuman. You know? That's so good. Yeah. That's what we wanted.
Yeah.
It's true. And Paramount was thrilled with it, because it was the biggest success, $97 million worldwide. It set a world record for first day box office gross. Leonard Nimoy was not going to be in it. He didn't want to be in it. They enticed him back to be Spock because they promised him a death scene, a memorable death scene. So that's the only reason he came back. It was very swashbuckling. The music, I love the soundtrack to Wrath of Khan. It is, James Horner did that one, and really exciting and gets your blood pumping. And it's that, you know, when the ships are admittedly boringly chasing each other through the nebula, the music is keeping you on the edge of your seat, you know? And of course, Ricardo Montalban as Khan is a delight. Really is.
Yeah.
Oh, I've given you no word to keep.
That's right.
Yeah.
In my opinion, you simply have no alternative. Yeah. You know, just
and that's and by the way, so again, all the things that people want in a movie, right? A villain that gives those speeches and gloats and you know, it emotes, and you know, again, as opposed to like, oh, it's this menace in space and it looks like a big space cloud.
So
all the wonderful banter, like Mark said, all the banter is back between all the characters. And that's what we loved in the first place. And you know, it's funny that the director, Nicholas Meyer, who actually directed Time After Time, was one of my favorite movies.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And so it's funny that apparently one of the Paramount executives really just wanted him on Star Trek The Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
And that's why they brought him in. But you know, he delivered in spades, man. That the Wrath of Khan from beginning to end is just a delight to watch.
Yeah.
Filled with wonderful character moments and completely amazing over the top megalomaniacal villain speeches delivered by you know, Mr. Rich Corinthian Leather himself.
He's a perfect analogy, and I love the fact that they used Ahab as the model for it.
With thee,
Hell's
heart, I stab at thee.
Right from the book, directly from the book.
Yeah.
My last breath at thee. Oh, yeah, straight out. And the notion that Kirk is his white whale is just even more delicious, you know. That's always something that I've always attributed to classic Trek, you know. Mm-hmm. They never had a problem with doing this sort of rich analogy, and it's okay if we reference an 18th century novel about the American experience, because you know, why wouldn't you know.
There are moments in that movie that to this day, I mean, I can't watch Star Trek The Wrath of Khan without, and I'm not ashamed to admit it, there are two points when they're doing the Spock funeral and Kirk is given the speech and he breaks. Just once, he says, of all the souls I've known in my travels, his was the most, and he pauses, he goes, human, barely keep it. It's that word. I just got chills just now. My eyes are watering because he just, oh my God. And then at the end, when Bones says, how do you feel? And he's gazing out at the stars and he says, I feel young.
Yeah.
I love that. What a great coda on that.
Yeah.
And of course we all know that Spock is not gone forever.
Right.
Because in 1984, Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. What do you guys think of that one?
It's a mixed bag.
Yeah.
You know, because as much as I liked the fact that they found a kind of a cool way to bring Spock back, and that was, you know, sort of necessary. I understand why Nimoy wanted out, but really, what was he going to do? Invasion of the Body Snatchers? Come on. You know, that took off like a house on fire. But I'll tell you what makes the movie for me. You know, it's not Merrick Buttrick, it's Christopher Lloyd.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. What an inspired, you know, and he's a blunt instrument. You know, he's a club with nails sticking out of it. You know, he's Lucille in Klingon form. Yeah. And I just love the fact that he sets up this beautiful the scene that allows Kirk's son to be heroic, but he doesn't have a chance against the Klingons. And that scene where Kirk sits down and says, "You Klingon bastard, you've killed my son." That's the other scene. That's the scene that makes me. The movie's dark. It's got some dark stuff in it, you know.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
But Chris Lloyd. Oh, that's his movie, and he runs with it. Yeah.
I have had enough of you.
yeah. No, and of course, and that led to many, many instances of people, you know, doing Kruger's like, "All right, Kirk, you convinced me." It's basically, you know, it's his Reverend Jim character as Krug. Right. We're Klingons. All right, we're Klingons.
You say you don't want to give me the Genesis device? Okie dokie.
Yeah, exactly. Okie dokie. Oh God. No, I actually like Star Trek Search for Spock. Again, also screenplay, a score by James Horner, with wonderful music again. He brings back a lot of the themes that he developed in Wrath of Khan. Because that is one of the ones, like, Motion Picture, of course, had the Jerry Goldsmith soundtrack, which had the theme that it was later used for Next Generation. Okay. But Wrath of Khan and Search of Spock both had a different Star Trek theme. They did not use the classic, they used a different one.
Or even they would touch on the original TV theme.
The TV one, but not what later became associated, that
became Next Generation's theme all through it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I like it. I'm actually fond of the Search for Spock. You know,
in Search for Spock. Well, Kirk does lose a son. He also loses the love of his life, the Enterprise.
Oh, no.
And that was one of those moments, too, that, you know, you're right. It was dark and the Enterprise is destroyed. And you're like, what? You know, and even watching it going down in flames, and Kirk was like, what have I done? You know, there's a real moment there of, you know, a captain, you know, should go down with his ship. I just think that Kirk is one of those characters, and we can debate it all night long, but he loves that ship. He loves that ship. He loves being captain of that ship. Admiral wasn't enough for him. It didn't, you know, I feel young. I want to be on this ship again. I want to be doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And for him to self-destruct the Enterprise like that is, it was hard. It was hard to watch.
He was never meant to be an admiral. He was always meant to be a captain out there on the ship.
Right.
I remember finding that moment, you know, honestly, like, more shocking than the death of his son or anything like that, you know, when they blow up the Enterprise and it goes flaming down into the atmosphere of the planet. I was like, holy crap.
That would be like Han Solo taking the Falcon out. I mean, the Enterprise is a character unto itself, you know.
I know this ship like the back of my hand.
Tong!
Tong! So with our next feature was The Voyage Home. Much lighter, full of comedic elements in that one. Now, that was the one, of course, with the whales.
Yep.
When they had to go back in time to get whales. Now, talk about an environmental message. Here's this alien race that comes every, I don't know, 1,000 years. I don't know exactly what it is, but it wants to communicate. And the only thing that kept it at bay was the response, apparently, from our earthbound whales, these giant, gentle mammals that live in the sea. But mankind being mankind, we've hunted them to extinction. There are no whales on Earth anymore. So now this alien race is calling and they don't get the response. You know, things are bad. Right.
Yep.
And they need whales. So the ship is gone. The Enterprise is gone. What they do have is the Klingon bird of prey, that big Klingon thing that they stole in the last film. Right. So they use that. They go back in time. Fortunately, it has a cloaking device that helps. But the comedy ensues, of course, when we get Kirk and Bones and Spock and company running through modern America, San Francisco, to be exact, to try to get whales.
Yep. No, it's a good one. I think that's another. Nicholas Meyer, by the way, co-wrote the screenplay for that, directed by Leonard Nimoy. But no, it has, and this is what I liked about these four films. You know, we probably won't talk about anything after this, but these four films, each of them had an element to it that harkened back, in my opinion, that harkened back to some of the original episodes, right? They all felt kind of like, oh, it's one of those kind of episodes. You know, the motion picture felt like that. Wrath of Khan, it's one of those episodes. You know, ooh, the Search for Spock. And Voyage Home, same thing. There were plenty of episodes that were lighter, had a lot more humor in them. You know, the stakes were high, but always keeping in mind the wonderful banter between the characters, the important friendships, you know, the frustrations that they felt with each other. And I think Voyage Home really is kind of, in a way, when the original cast in the movies kind of hit their stride. Mm-hmm. I think by Voyage Home, we're really comfortable now with this, with the original Star Trek cast in movies, in films. Yeah. I wish the movies after Voyage Home would have continued with that and kept going with that and would have been just as good. But yeah, I think I'm a big fan of the Voyage Home.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with that. And I also think that, your point about this being that kind of episode, this is definitely an episode like piece of the action. This movie, where they're all dressed up and they're trying to get their 20th century idioms correct.
Right. You know?
And Kirk keeps saying stuff like, I think he did a little too much LDS in the
60s. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's just... I love that
Bones gives the guy the pill and he grows another liver. I mean...
Give me a pill. I feel so much better.
Yeah.
This is like the Middle Ages, you know?
Yes. You know, the whole transparent aluminum. How do we know he didn't invent the thing?
Right.
Oh, yeah.
I'm looking for the nuclear vessels. Nuclear vessels.
And at this point, you know, they have borked the timeline so thoroughly.
Oh, yeah.
Just not even, but again, that's part of the fun of the movie. And I do think I sort of wish it was a better high note to go out on. Mm-hmm. I think it would have been.
Yeah,
but they didn't
go out on that, of course. They had The Final Frontier, followed by The Undiscovered Country. And that's where the official end of the original series films came. Yeah. Yeah. We did get a little bit more of Kirk, though. And Bones showed up in an early episode of Next Generation, a very, 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 very old Bones. Spock, being an alien, lived much longer. Kirk had what some might call a decent exit in the film Generations. And that was the very first Star Trek, The Next Generation movie.
Yeah, that was the passing of the torch, so to speak.
Officially.
Yeah.
William Shatner says he didn't know why Kirk had to die. And he was told by Paramount, it's for money. It's for the ratings. People want to see, you know, they feel that we could really capitalize on Next Generation if we get rid of Captain Kirk and officially passing the torch. That sort of thing. I enjoy watching Captain Picard, and nothing against Picard fans. Love Picard. Great guy. But I liked watching Captain Picard try to fight Malcolm McDowell and get his ass handed to him. And then he goes and fetches Kirk, who stands on the bridge like a bulldog. And Malcolm McDowell tries to do all this space karate on him. And Kirk, of course, kicks his ass because it's Kirk.
Right.
Picard couldn't get the job done. The first time.
I like the space karate.
Yeah. But Kirk, you know, and of course, at the end of it, the battle, the bridge collapses and Kirk is crushed and he's laying there dying under the bridge. And his final words cause a lot of controversy in the Trekker community. They don't like to be called Trekkies, folks. Trekker community.
I prefer to think of myself as a Trekkite.
Nice. Kirk's final words before he died. He says, it was fun. Followed shortly by his actual last words, he looks into something unseen. He looks beyond Picard. He looks beyond the planet. He looks beyond everything, and he sees something, and he says, oh, my.
Oh, my. Yeah.
All right.
Like something he's never seen before.
Right,
I kind of like that. I kind of like that exit for him, you know?
Yeah.
In battle. Going down in battle. Right?
Yeah.
For what it was, I thought I it was definitely time, you know. Mm-hmm. I actually think that that Six has a moment. You know, the best thing about the movies was that they weren't afraid every once in a while to cut loose.
Yeah.
And the final scene in Star Trek Six, where Sulu has the Excelsior. And he's going to intercept, you know, and the Klingons are battling the Enterprise and there's problems and, you know, and they're doing the trans warp thing and the helmsman says, sir, at that speed she'll fly apart. He says, then fly her apart, you know?
Yeah.
And when he warps in, it's just this like, you know, it's like watching the cavalry come in. It's like, oh my God, here we go. And now there's And even though I know that that there was no love between these guys, you got to give credit to George Takei for actually selling it when he says, you know, it was good to see you in action one last time, sir. That to me is stick in the dismount.
So many licensed products based on, you know, Star Trek franchise. We talked about the Amigos, of course, but we also had comic books and novels, video games. Oh my gosh. I mean, just so many other different things that came out in regards inspired by magazines, just a cultural impact, naming space shuttles, you know, and putting James Doohan's ashes into space is one of those things that makes me smile. You know, this is inspired some technologies as well. People who grew up watching Star Trek and became scientists or technologically advanced people who work at Google Earth or, you know, whatever, they invent things and they name them after Star Trek pieces, you know. They're inspired by this fantastic future where they know we can do better. We should do better and we can do better. It's multicultural, multiracial cast. Star Trek, it is, you know, you got a Japanese helmsman, a Russian navigator, a black female communications officer, and a human Vulcan hybrid first officer. I mean, it is groundbreaking in so many ways, but really it helps us as humanity. It helps us if we think about it in terms of our everyday life. Why not? Why can't we achieve that? And what do we do to achieve that? And that's what Star Trek is to me, more than anything else, more than the costumes and the characters and the monsters and the aliens. It is a social commentary on how we as humans can and should be better.
Yep.
Yeah. I like to think of it as sort of knowing that we're going to figure it out. We may not have all the answers and we may not get it right the first time, mm-hmm. but we're going to figure it out. And I feel that way more about especially original Trek than probably any other TV show. You know, that's one of the few shows that gives me hope still to this day. It gives me hope.
I mean, people talk about how often, you know, well, we're not, you know, clearly we're not heading towards a Star Trek future, and look at how tribal we are and this and that. And Star Trek fans are like, no, remember, we have to go through the whole eugenics wars. We still have to have nuclear conflict so we can still get to Star Trek. But, you know, it's just going to take us a couple hundred more years of us destroying each other.
There was an episode and one of these things that I really enjoyed, of the TV show Futurama, that was completely devoted to Star Trek, and the character of Philip Fry, voiced of course by Billy West, is a huge Star Trek fan. Of course, he goes into the future, Futurama, the premise of the animated show, very clever show. But he finds out that Star Trek is, no one talks about Star Trek. No one even, you know, it's forbidden to talk about Star Trek. He said, what are you talking about? They took all the movies and all the TV shows, and they jettisoned them into space. You know, the whole episode though is a standout because a lot of the original cast came back to do their voices of their heads inside of jars. You guys remember that one? And it's one of my favorite episodes. It talks about, because Fry, he waxes poetic about Star Trek and what he remembers versus what it really is. And at the end, all the jibes and the commentary that they've got, the heads talking to each other about the old stuff. I really enjoy that one. And I enjoy any kind of Star Trek gag or parody. We talked about what was the movie with Sigourney Weaver and Tim Allen?
Galaxy Quest.
Yes. Galaxy Quest.
One of my favorite movies. One of my favorite films.
Galaxy. That's Star Trek, you know? Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. What's his name? The guy that does Family Guy, Seth MacFarlane.
Yeah.
Seth MacFarlane has his new show.
That's true. The
Orville, which is absolutely
stakes out that territory. Yeah, it definitely stakes out that territory.
Okay, gentlemen, I think we have time for one last Star Trek trivia question.
All right, I'm ready.
Lay it on.
Not doing so good, so.
Yeah, I know. Well, we got the Yorktown, but that's about it.
Okay. I'm going to give you the multiple choice on this one because I couldn't begin. What weapon did Kirk and Spock use when they fought for possession of T'Pring, during Spock's Ponfar ritual in Amok Time? Was it A, the Lerpa? Okay. B, the Kabar? Okay. C, the Mortais? Okay. Or the D, the Mekleth?
Mekleth sounds like a Klingon weapon, so it wasn't that. Mm-hmm. What were the ones again? Give us the choices again.
Lerpa, L-A-R-P-A, the Lerpa, the Kabar, the Mortais, M-O-R-T-A-E-S, Mortais, or the Mekleth.
I want to say it's that middle one.
The Kabar.
The second one. What was the second one?
The Kabar was the second one. That's not it.
And what's the third one?
Not the Mortais. It wasn't the Lerpa. It's the Lerpa.
Oh my God!
Yes, that's the Vulcan weapon consisting of a wooden staff a little over a meter in length with a semicircular blade at one end and a metal bludgeon on the other. The Lerpa.
I was good at this. I'm gonna have to go rewatch these now. This is embarrassing.
No. Well, we finished our drinks and we're getting the red eye. So folks, we're gonna wrap up this. There's so much to talk about Star Trek. We could have gone on for a lot longer, but we decided to go ahead and keep it to the original series. Yep. But fear not, I'm sure there will be another gathering at the Lobot Lounge where we'll discuss Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, the other ones that I don't know.
And the others. And the rest. It's like Jordan Thailand. And the rest.
I'm sure there are some people out there who are losing their minds. And I apologize. You could send all hate mail to Aaron D'Arrive, care of Jonathan. By the way, The Gentleman Nerds is a Cloak and Dagger production and is written by Aaron D'Arrive, Mark Finn, Ben Gibbs, and Joseph Fotinos, with additional material provided by the United Federation of Planets. Music composed and performed by the amazingly talented Ben Gibbs. Promotional material, logos, and the Gentleman Nerds mascot, legendary but nameless, created by artistic goddess Michelle Fitzpatrick. The Lobot Lounge bouncer is Maximilian, and our special guest bartender was Montgomery Scott. Ah, the Romulan ale. You thought I was going to say Guinan, didn't you? Our sound editor, mixer, and intentional producer is Ben Gibbs. Our executive producer and the man we all pray never gets superpowers is Aaron D'Arrive. The first Emmy Award won by Star Trek was for the animated series in 1975. Kirk's middle name is Tiberius, and the first captain of the Enterprise was Christopher Pike. And Mark Farnash is the man in the gorilla suit. Web hosting by Rustix Interactive. Technical assistance provided by Blythe Christopher D'Arrive. Please join us in the Lobot Lounge when next we open. And remember, tip your bartenders and your waitstaff. Final words, Mark Finn.
Only this. James Kirk was a father figure to me, growing up in the absence of a dad. And so, I've always, identify with him as one of my aspects of masculinity, even if I knew in my heart, I could never get there. So, I always try when I'm working out a solution that involves masculinity, my first thought is what would Kirk do?
I like it. Aaron, final words.
Just to pass on a little bit more of my learned Klingon, folks, if you ever find yourself stranded on a Klingon vessel, you must remember this phrase, Nuk Dak Duk Tapol, which means, where do you keep the chocolate?
Oh, nice. Nice. That's come in handy. And I'm Joseph Fotinos, reminding you all once again that Red Skull lives.
The only Klingon I remember is Jaj, which is I understand, and of course Kutvok, which is what you would basically say to start a fight.
Oh yeah.
There's Kapla, some
Kapla
there's some
is success.
There.
Kapla is success, and it is. So if someone says Klingon kol dajatla, do you speak Klingon? You would say Gobe Klingon kol vichatlakbe.